I spoke with someone else who served in Afghanistan.
My name is Captain Mark Lyndhurst of the Coldstream Guards, and I was serving in Afghanistan for approximately 7 months. The first five were relatively quiet, dealing with your usual explosions, shootings. About 5 months in, I was involved in an explosion. We drove over what we think was a Russian anti-tank mine, largely saved by the soft sand that was beneath it, and it blew a crater in the ground. And I walked away largely physically unhurt. Everyone else walked away with some broken bones. I came home and went back to Afghanistan after my leave, and I got immediately flown to a place called Nadi Ali, where I was on the last transport to actually make it in there in about 7 weeks. Just after I got in there, when the Taliban surrounded us, cut off our position. And then we proceeded for the next 7 weeks to defend our position whilst the army was unable to come and rescue us. There was people running out of food, running out of ammunition, there were problems with water. We were under contact every day that we were there. Things got so bad at one point that the RAF refused to fly in because it was too great a risk to them. So they started dropping all our supplies. We'd watch our supplies drift slowly towards the Taliban lines and then have to go out and fight for them. And all through this, as a young officer, your duty is to do what you're told from above and also to look after your soldiers. And that leaves you in the middle, being incredible pressure and incredibly alone. Because when soldiers look at you and go, boss, why are we doing this? But in some level, you've got to sympathise, because you can't just tell them to shut up and get on with it because the situation is ridiculous. But on the other level, you need to come up with an answer and come up with a reason that they follow you back out the gate next day, even though you know you're going to get shot at. 7 weeks of that. That's what left me with my PTSD. It took just over a year before I was actually diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, over which period of time the post-traumatic stress built up until it got to a critical point in which it was eventually noticed. The predominant symptom is the obsessive thoughts, the continual rethinking of the situation. It's been a lot of therapy and just talking, because a lot of the feelings that I was caught up in, again, largely to do with the army, there is this sense of fear when these things happen. And that's something that you feel very, particularly as a commander, you feel quite ashamed of, because you think that you should be able to deal with things much better. And you know that your priority is to actually put that aside and carry on. You've also got a set of very high standards to work to. But you go through and you do all this training back at home, and you try and get everything as perfect as possible. But then the reality of it is, when these things happen in war, the scenario isn't perfect. There are things you have to adapt to. And there are many, many, many limitations that you can't really reconcile. And so you're quite often left with this sort of overarching feeling of, I could have done better. The army lives in this wonderful alpha male type sort of world where it plays on, you know, machismo and ego. And those are the things that helps make it bold and strong and carry it through a lot of these times, and particularly allows you to lead. But sometimes it captures you there, and you forget about the other side of things, about emotion, about compassion, and the other parts that make up the human condition.
And what kind of advice would you give anyone that's experiencing PTSD, whether they were in the military or otherwise?
There's only really one thing, which is just, and it's the hardest thing to do, you need to talk to somebody, you need to tell somebody. So my story is, when I came back, it took me over a year to actually speak to anyone about things, and that was largely through being pretty much frog marched to a doctor by some very close friends when it got to a point in time that it was beyond obvious that there was a problem. But you're very concerned and caught up in yourself, to the point actually that quite often you don't really want to talk to other people about it. One, for fear that you're boring them, because it's on your mind the whole time. And two, because you're often living in this world of fear or guilt, or you're having problems reconciling your own thoughts. And they've usually become confused because you relive these moments, and you relive them, you know, and the memory's an odd thing. You're not really remembering actually what was going on. And before you know it, you've remembered it so many times that it's become a confusion and a fantasy. You don't really feel justified in telling it to anyone, because it's a very personal problem. But if you don't, it finds other ways to escape, and people turn to alcohol, to drugs. Now, alcohol in particular, although to a certain degree it quashes these thoughts, it also provides a vehicle for them to come alive and just express them, or at least the emotions, the anger, the fear, and everything to come out. In my case, it ended up with self-harm and suicide attempts. So once I actually started talking to the therapists, it was by no means a quick fix. I was in and out of therapy on a number of occasions. There was a lot of denial. And I was very lucky to have a close sort of support network of friends and family who sort of held my hand and kept me fighting, and helped me find the help I needed. You know, you talk to a therapist and you work through the emotion and you rationalize the emotion as well to an extent. And you look at things and say, well, actually, I was afraid. Is that okay? And the answer is, well, yes. I'm still by no means cured, and there's a lot of things that still affect me now, although possibly on the outside you wouldn't see them. One thing that happened to me when I was in Afghanistan was that I was blown up in a snatch Land Rover. So we were driving along through the desert and hit an anti-tank mine. Four of us in the vehicle, three ended up being Casavat Pats of the UK, and I walked away with a small cut to my left shin, which I was in command of the vehicle, left me very much questioning what right I had to be alive. And, you know, the next day I was out patrolling again, so I hadn't had the time to actually sit down, you know, have a cup of tea and a fag, and allow my mind and body to catch back up with each other. When we still want to start doing my therapy, there's a technique that was used called EMDR, which is a lot of tapping and bits and bobs. Apparently it's very close to hypnosis. And nobody seems to be able to understand or be able to explain exactly what it does, but it's very good at changing acute thought patterns. Now, a vehicle, when it gets blown up in the desert, there is one smell that will stay with me for the rest of my life, and it's this mix of tar and sand and diesel, and it's horrific, and it stings the back of your throat and stings the back of your nostrils. And it's something that I could never really get rid of. But sometimes if you're walking past, like, roadworks where there was bitumen boiling or tarmac boiling, it's that same acrid smell. And something like that would flick me back in an instant. But the EMDR was something they used in particular to tackle that one situation because it was so acute. We talked about the bad situation, and then there's this sort of tapping going on. And then we talked about good things. And as far as I understand, what it does is it changes the neural pathway so that you're going, duh, 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 duh. You were going bitumen, explosion, good God, I'm nearly dead. And instead you're going bitumen, explosion, it's a nice day.
Thanks to Mark Lindhurst. And Mark talked about EDMR, so eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. This is a treatment that was developed by clinical psychologist Dr. Francine Shapiro in the 1980s. It involves making side-to-side eye movements and listening to taps whilst recalling the traumatic incident. It's thought that this left-right eye movement stimulates the brain in a similar way to REM sleep, so rapid eye movement sleep, when your eyes move rapidly from side to side. During this phase of sleep, memory reinforcement seems to happen, so it's in this way that EDMR could have changed how Mark reacted to cues in the environment and stopped his flashbacks. We've had some questions.